Hello?
Is this Sue Renard?
Yes.
The Sue Renard whose mother's maiden name is Parker and who shops at Super Saver where she buys way too many pretzels?
Well, yes, but...
The Sue Renard who contributes to Democratic campaigns and Greenpeace but not to religious groups?
Hey, stop! Who is this?
Whose bank balances...
How do you know all that? I get the feeling that nothing is really private anymore. That's why I think you should tune in to Privacy or Trying to Mind Your Own Business from Mind's Eye Radio. You'll hear how one woman had her identity stolen and discover a new service to help you remember your passwords. All that and much more on Privacy or Trying to Mind Your Own Business on this radio station. From Mind's Eye Radio, it's radio within reach.
How many people do you think know your credit card numbers? Perhaps your social security number? Would you want someone mapping your entire genetic code? Is invasion of privacy justified at times for the common good? Welcome to Privacy, or Trying to Mind Your Own Business on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It is locally written and produced by Mind's Eye Audio Productions and The Writer's Place. In the first half hour, you'll hear a variety of views on what privacy means in this information age and what a struggle it is to protect information you think should be private. In 1988, Lisa Lowe returned a purse she found to her school's office. In turn, the vice principal had her stripped to make sure she had not stolen anything out of that purse. Privacy may be considered a right to many, but to teens, it is a luxury. Writer Karen Schultz gives us a backdrop for our current inalienable right to privacy and explains why many teenagers are alienated by their own privacy rights.
The right to privacy is not specifically mentioned in the Bill of Rights. However, the ability of the government to unreasonably interfere with one's personal decisions is implied by the Constitution and is covered by various laws and acts. For example, Roe v. Wade provided the right for women to make their own reproductive decisions without the intrusion of the government. But laws are not part of the Constitution and can have amendments and stipulations attached to them. Politicians choose a segment of the population which does not vote, is unaware of the issues, or unable to be politically active, and convinces the other segments of the population that these people may make decisions which could hurt everyone else. The teenage population is often chosen for this use. One of the most extensive and impeding changes to Roe v. Wade are the parental consent laws. These laws, adopted by many states, make teens ask a parent for permission to have an abortion, regardless if the child was impregnated by the parent. In 1943, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that minors have the same, quote, ordinary constitutional rights, unquote, adults have. Nevertheless, parental and adult concerns have often been seen as more valuable than teenage privacy rights. Nowhere is this more convincing than in public schools. Although the Fourth Amendment disallows unreasonable search and seizure for all citizens, the case of New Jersey versus TLO allowed minors in public schools to have their lockers and persons randomly searched. The level of intrusion varies state to state and school district to school district, often depending on the degree of public fear. The Privacy Act of 1974 says that agencies cannot use information for any other use than it is collected. The provisions for teenagers, again, is limited. Schools must release grades and student information to parents, but some states do not allow the students themselves to access the information. When a child reaches 18 and is no longer considered a minor, the records are then their private information. The right to privacy is not guaranteed for teenagers. As a group making important and private decisions without the right to vote, they will continue to struggle to direct their own lives. Since they are often used as a political entity without political power, all rights, including privacy rights, are vulnerable to be lost under the guise of parental and public concern. When making changes to privacy laws, we must be careful about sacrificing the rights of teens or any other group. We may achieve public rest in the short term, but the underlying problems will remain, and the long-term results may be diminished privacy for everyone. This is Karen Schultz for Mind's Eye Radio and Writer's Place.
Violations of the Fourth Amendment are justified in many cases as protection for the public good and common interest. According to Tom Neal, what lies at the heart of unreasonable search and seizures is the issue of sovereignty. Kelly Warren spoke with Tom Neal, a city employee and former mayoral candidate, who thinks society has pushed the public interest issue too far.
The defining moment was probably the day I was taken in for a random drug test as a city worker and tested positive for marijuana use. I have always felt sort of philosophically, I've been philosophically opposed to the drug wars and felt this was an invasion of my privacy. It was a violation of the Fourth Amendment and was very vocal about that.
What were some of the issues when you were running for mayor? Were they privacy issues?
Well, of course, my feeling is that I didn't want to be a one-trick pony and just concentrate on drugs, but that what I would call the assault and demolition of the Fourth Amendment is fundamental to who we are as a community. Privacy didn't actually come up as a specific issue other than on the slightly more elevated sort of libertarian level of our rights as city workers to do what you want in your free time, or how much autonomy and sovereignty do we have as individual members of the community and as neighborhoods. The fundamental issue is really sovereignty, I think. I mean, behind the privacy issue, which is fundamental to who we are as a culture and how we interact with each other as individuals, behind that stands the sovereignty issue of who's actually in charge here. Does the state have the right to intervene in our lives, tell us what we can and cannot smoke, where we can and cannot smoke it, what we can and cannot put in our bodies, do with our bodies? Does the state have the right to do this? And that revolves around the sovereignty issue.
The violation of civil liberties is entwined in the sovereignty issue?
Yes, it is absolutely, because if we are in fact sovereign people, our persons, properties, and effects should be secure from intrusion by the state except for probable cause. In other words, if you're seen sticking a machine gun out the window, the community has the right to see to it that nothing happens, but they don't have the right to break down your door and come searching for weapons, say, or for drugs or for pornography, simply because somebody tipped them off that it might be there.
So what's the argument that we're working for the public good? How do you argue that argument?
Well, let's put it this way. The common good is served best by leaving people alone, in my opinion. When the state criminalizes victimless activity, they are basically writing themselves a carte blanche to run roughshod over any of us at any time for purposes that have nothing whatever to do with the supposed infraction of this supposed public good. We have more people in prison in California for life for marijuana than there are for rapes and murders combined. This, in terms of the money we're expending, is not for the public good. Almost 3/5 of all federal prisoners in the federal prison system are there for minor marijuana offenses. This is not serving the public interest. It is a war against the American people.
That was Tom Neal, former mayoral candidate and current city employee. Kelly Warren spoke with him at Mother Fool's Coffee House on Williamson Street. The O.J. Simpson trial brought DNA into the spotlight. Now genetics is gaining ground as a tracking tool to trace criminals, identify people at risk for diseases, and discover the origins of human beings. But as the influence of biotechnology grows, it's getting harder to remain genetically anonymous. Linda Hart discusses how privacy issues are getting high-tech and personal.
It used to be we were tracked by Social Security numbers, our mother's maiden name, even fingerprints. Now our DNA, the coils of genes that make us unique, is at stake. Whether we know it or not, every time we give blood, lick a stamp, or brush hair off our sleeves, we're leaving behind a genetic trail. And the trend is to use these genetic fingerprints as one more tool to identify us. In Germany, 16,000 men from a rural town were asked to give saliva samples. The reason? To track a killer by matching DNA samples to those left at the crime scene. Never mind that the techniques used weren't foolproof. The DNA hunt was justified, police say, to sniff out the person who murdered an 11-year-old girl. United States isn't immune to such genetic tactics. For years, the government has collected blood samples from convicted criminals and army recruits. And every newborn gets a blood stick, used to test for genetic diseases. The fear is this genetic information will become part of a national DNA databank to trace all citizens, much like fingerprints, only more revealing, since DNA can tell about a person's probable medical future. Fuel for the DNA craze comes partly from the Human Genome Project, an effort begun in 1990 to identify and map sequences of DNA found in human chromosomes. With a genetic blueprint for a human being eventually in hand, scientists hope to characterize and possibly cure a range of genetic ills. Researchers have already discovered genetic links to everything from breast cancer to personality disorders. But it's not always clear that knowing genetic information, such as knowing you carry a defective gene, is helpful. And in the hands of insurance companies or employers, it may be harmful. To be sure, some scientists and ethicists find the gene frenzy a tad alarming. James Watson, a Nobel laureate and co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, calls the idea of a national DNA databank repulsive. But so far, no federal guidelines protect genetic privacy nor prevent discrimination based on genetics. Still, 15 states have passed genetic privacy laws, and bills are pending in 30 states. With the success of DNA technology, it's a small wonder that the cart of technology got before the horse, and only now are people considering the ethical fallout. Like other privacy issues, genetic privacy is clouded in confusion. What is DNA anyway? How can something you can't even see be tied to identity? What does it mean to have a defective gene? How accurate are the tests? And who has access to the information? You might say our genetic privacy is our most precious kind, and probably the most revealing of all our identities we hold private. After all, our unique genetic makeup is tied to our medical destinies, our ancestors, our most personal reproductive decisions. It's possible to change our other identities, dye our hair, move, take up an alias. But genetic identities can't be shed or faked. It's who we are. One privacy rights lawyer calls efforts to use genetic information akin to reading a person's private diary. Even more dangerous, it's a diary that contains pages of our past, present, and future. And in some cases, we don't even know it's being read. This is Linda Hart.
An update on the German story. Last week, German officials in the DNA hunt to find a killer announced they had a positive match. One of the 16,000 samples matched the DNA found at the crime scene. Police say the DNA belonged to a man in a neighboring town who later confessed to the murder. Most Americans consider privacy a God-given right, not a privilege. But to live in a safe society, do we have to be willing to give up some of that personal freedom? In light of recent events, commentator Fran Rawl questions whether this privacy invasion might be in the public's best interest.
I wonder if many people take it personally. I never have. How they handle their security is up to them. Why would they put all those big plastic knobs on each garment if they didn't have to? A German friend of mine found out about the knobs the hard way when she dashed outside the store to look for her girls who'd wandered out of sight. The alarm that sounded didn't mean anything to her, so she was amazed, embarrassed, and bewildered when she found out that they were checking for thieves. Sure, things can get stupid. A long time ago, a clerk wouldn't let me take more than 3 bathing suits into the try-on booth. I pointed out to her this was a good general policy, no doubt, but I was the only customer in the store, and it was almost closing time, and she could probably count. We ended by having her stand outside and hand them in one by one. I was secretly very pleased when none of them fit, so she lost the sale. But generally, when I'm in a big outlet store and they hand me a big plastic number for the articles I'm trying on, it's okay with me. Otherwise, they probably would have a lot of things smuggled out underneath other clothes. Again, I think they do it for a reason or they wouldn't have to bother with it. When my daughter was younger, we were in a big outlet store of some sort, and when we headed for the only dressing room, the curtain wasn't pulled, and a man was trying on some jeans. I was a little bothered by this, until my daughter patiently explained, "Well, after all, Mother, he is wearing his shorts. No need for numbers there. Public scrutiny is the best deterrent, no doubt." I guess one of the best reasons for checking parcels is that it's a protection for everyone in the store. Who knows what's inside packs, or white plastic pails, for that matter. This horrifying incident on a Madison bus shows that it's a scary world out there now. Since we don't pack a rod, it didn't bother us that Macy's in Phoenix, Arizona had a sign outside the door, "No handguns." When we have a law about bearing personal arms, can you envision buying a sign that says, "Guns permitted" or "No guns permitted"? Alphabetically, you'd find these right behind the garage sale signs. It's helpful when malls provide lockers to put your packages in, but airports have a different problem. In England, we were unable to put our luggage into a big locker because the door wouldn't close. When we inquired about this, we found that none of the doors would close, and all luggage had to be put into a personally checked space. They were afraid of IRA bombs. Thinking back over it all, it seems we're headed into a time in which people have to check all personal items outside the malls in a concrete bunker. This is Fran Rall reporting for Mind's Eye Radio.
Where do you draw the line on your privacy? Take your Social Security number, for instance. We know that having a Social Security number doesn't mean there's a stack of money in Washington, D.C. with our name on it. Commentator Gay Davidson-Zilski wonders if we become too accustomed to thinking of this 9-digit number as merely a symbolic formality. As her close encounters prove, there are few numbers that can make us so insecure as the SSN.
Socially secure? Not so fast. Social Security incident number one. I approached the cashier, desperate to get out fast, since the shopping wasn't recreational and I was double parked, watching Barney Fife eye my car. It was a hot day in a small town where nobody knew me and everybody had prickly heat, and of course, shuffle the deck though I tried, I could not find my driver's license, so the pimply clerk could scrawl the number on my check, thus verifying my identity. "Can you take this?" I pleaded, holding up my university faculty ID. "Doesn't look much like you," the clerk muttered. "It's 20 years old," I snipped haughtily, thinking, "just you wait." "Well, okay," she said, copying down my ID number, which I realized too late was my Social Security number. I sighed and hoped the bank would eventually shred the check and I wouldn't be featured as the poster child idiot who gave out her SSN on a check like this one here. But with luck, the check would be turned into confetti compost and no 20-year younger, 20-pound lighter brunette of the future would grab my very being. I haven't given out my Social Security number willingly since I married Ken 10 years ago. Before that, I had everything printed on my checks: Social Security number, address, phone number, astrological sign, major. Ken was way ahead of the curve on this privacy issue. He knew a long time ago why it was a bad idea to release your SSN. It's like printing your bank account number on your forehead. There are plenty of people cruising around today who know how to use this sort of data, but it was just too hot in a small town, double parked, you know. Incident number two made me ashamed to be alive in the late 20th century when you do have to be worried all the time. My father had entered the hospital for an angiogram and had been told that he would instead need a quadruple heart bypass. Since I had expected to spend only one half day in Rockford with him, I called Ken and asked him to drive down to sit vigil with me through the long hours of the operation. Flying out of the house here in Madison, he had stubbed his toe so badly that by the time he arrived in Rockford, he needed medical care. So yada, 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 and Dad is in surgery, and Ken visits the ER, shows his insurance card, gets stitches, and is altogether not too pleasant when the receptionist asks for his Social Security number. He refuses. Well, she hadn't had such a great day either, buddy. And how do you expect your insurance company to pay for it if we can't file a claim? And what's that? Well, how can you be sure they have it already? Well, fine. And Ken left in a huff. Poor nurse couldn't know that this is a hot button with him, even when he's not tired and in pain. But I realized, as the doors of the ER squeezed shut, our insurance is my policy. So I called and told him I was sorry, honey, but I had to rat you out, even though I know you were right. I slunk back and gave the nurse his SSN. She sniffed and tapped the computer. I could see that she had already deep-sixed the claim out of spite. I jabbered something about my husband being a well-known non-complier and so on and so on, and could I just please, please go see my sick daddy? And I left in a huff also, angry and feeling a little more socially insecure. This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky for Mind's Eye Radio.
What do you do when someone steals your Social Security number and your credit history to open an account with the phone company? Pat Dejack talks with a woman who, by chance, discovered a neighbor had purloined her private financial information.
When I found out that someone had taken my Social Security number, I called the Social Security Administration to ask what I could do about it, and they gave me the names and the phone numbers of the three major credit bureaus.
How did you find out that someone had taken your Social Security number?
I moved here from Oregon in August, and around April I got a phone bill from US West, and my first clue that something was wrong was I opened it, and there was $500 worth of 900 calls. And I realized that actually the account was to my old building, but it was apartment 14, and I used to live in apartment 4, so it had actually been accidentally mailed to me.
Did you have any financial liability in this account?
No. I talked to several people at the phone company. Every time I talked to someone else, they had a different story. And one person tried to convince me that it was a friend of mine or a family member and that I was just screwed. But someone else said that since I could prove that I had never lived in that address, that I wasn't liable for it.
So this was someone who was living in the same building as you were?
Yeah. It's someone that my husband and I both knew who we kind of had some problems with. We basically think that he probably went through our mail or went through our trash to get some information about us. You know, the whole thing was that he thought that we stole his cat. There was about a week lag period between the time that he thought we stole his cat and, you know, the time he started coming after us with all this weird information he knew about us. He knew both my husband's and my full names, and he knew my husband's parents' name.
So how did you trace this back to him just because he was still in there?
Because he lived in that apartment. I called my old landlord at that building and asked who lived in apartment 14. We found out that this person's been evicted, so they haven't actually found him yet. Basically, what they're going to do is they're going to put a flag on my credit report. So anyone who checks my credit should see the flag, and they have to call me to make sure that it's okay before they extend credit.
So to protect your identity or your credit history and your Social Security number, are there any things that the Social Security Administration had recommended that you do?
One thing is I took it off of my student ID card.
Well, the university is in the process of changing that, but they're not the only ones that do that.
Yeah, it was easy to change the student ID number. The one problem is with my student loans, they won't change the number. You know, they're explaining because it's a federal loan, so your Social Security number has to be the account number, and there's nothing we can do to change that.
You had mentioned earlier that you had tried to see about changing your Social Security number and ran into some difficulties.
They just said that they don't usually do it with a fraudulent phone account because those happen all the time. You know, I guess if the crime was serious enough, like if he was just running up thousands of dollars of debt, then I could get my Social Security number changed. But they try to make that really hard to do because they don't want people dodging credit. Kind of worries me that the phone company didn't check my credit more carefully before they just extended it. I mean, it's like all they needed was a Social Security number and then some random person as a reference. I think it's just something that, like, no one's put enough thought into before setting up all these systems. Like, okay, it's really convenient to get information around, but how easy is it going to be to track someone down if they steal someone's social security number? They just didn't put enough safeguards into it. And, you know, people aren't taking, you know, identity switching seriously enough.
That was Pat Dejack and Erica, the subject of information theft. If you don't use your social security number for identification, perhaps you have special passwords or PIN numbers to protect your private information. But do we control the passwords? Or do the passwords control us? Writer Fran Zell envisions a new service to help with lost passwords.
Welcome to the Lost Password Support Hotline for the new millennium. In order to use this totally free voice-activated service, you must have a password. Please enter it now.
What? You mean I need a password to find a password?
If you have a password to this hotline, but can't remember it, please hang up and use our 900 number instead. Someone will assist you immediately.
I haven't forgotten it, you pirates. I don't have one.
If you don't have a password and would like help selecting one that you will never forget and that no one else will ever guess, you may use our 900 number also.
I couldn't do that if I wanted to. I don't know the password to my long-distance calling card.
Or hang up right now and ask a 12-year-old child for assistance.
Oh, very funny, lady.
Otherwise, just think of something, anything, but A, don't tell anyone else in the world what it is, and B, do not use profanity. Profanity in any language could be offensive to someone who happens to crack your code.
I'll give you profanity. This is the biggest crack of...
Thank you for entering your new password. For questions regarding your automatic teller machine password, email, chat room, or internet password, long-distance telephone service password, password service password, and all other password, say, who goes there?
I give up. Who goes there?
Welcome to Lost Password Assistance. All of our representatives are busy with other forgetful people. Please stay on the line. Meanwhile, have you considered a password insurance plan? This will cover you, your spouse, and other loved ones with whom you have dared to share your passwords. Passwords are the wave of the future. Passwords are the future, and the future is here. You will soon need a password for everything you do. If you had password insurance, you would not be having the problem you are having now. For information on password insurance, press the pound key or see our webpage at www.ins.charlatan.com.
Hello, this is Sherry, operator number 1492-3214/72*1. I will be happy to help you find your missing password, but first I will need some information. This includes your zip code.
Sure, Sherry. Whatever you say. Whatever you want. My zip code is 5...
Your zip code and your social security number, your mother's maiden name, your license plate number, driver's license number, library card number, grocery store discount card number, plus the number and expiration date of a major credit card.
Wait a minute. Are you crazy? I don't give that kind of information over the phone.
We need all that information, sir, in order to verify the search for your lost password.
But it's an invasion of privacy. It's an outrage.
All right, sir. One moment, sir. I will transfer you to our guessing game department. In order for us to process your call more quickly, please be ready to tell our representative whether your password was animal, mineral, or vegetable.
Animal? Mineral? Give me a break. Vegetable? Vegetable. That's it. It's my boss's name spelled backwards. He's a total vegetable. That's my password. Oh, thank you. Thank you. How can I ever thank you?
Thank you for calling the Lost Password Support Hotline for the new millennium.
Thanks to Janet Jones for her role as the computer voice, Eric Houghton as the desperate caller, and Fran Zell as Sherry, the real live operator. You're listening to Privacy, or Trying to Mind Your Own Business, written by the members of Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Gabe Davidson-Zilski, Pat Dijak, Linda Hart, Jim Novick, Fran Rahl, Sue Renard, Karen Schultz, Kelly Warren, and Fran Zell. Original music composed by Barbara Tusitt. If you'd like a cassette copy of this show or would like to join the Mind's Eye Radio Collective, call 608-256-6525. I'm Cole Hornaday, always trying to please my private audience.
Hi, I'm Sue Renard of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective. We started doing a show on turtle wax, It's Not Just for Cars, but along the way, we unexpectedly produced this really cool show on serendipity. You'll hear experts tell you that serendipity doesn't exist, but then a toddler finds it in every piece of grass, and a crazy woman tries to find it in every acquaintance. So try your luck and tune into Serendipity, finding what you're not looking for, here on Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach.
When Columbus bumped into America on the way to the Spice Islands, no one knew what to call this stroke of luck. But then, in the 18th century, Horace Walpole told of a Persian fairy tale of three princes of Serendip who had a remarkable gift of finding valuable things they weren't looking for. Now we know finding America wasn't a discovery. It was serendipity. Welcome to Serendipity, or Finding What You're Not Looking For, on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It's locally written and produced by Mind's Eye Audio Productions and The Writer's Place. In the first half hour, you'll hear experts question whether serendipity even exists, drop in on a serendipitous experiment, go to the dog races, and explore whether serendipity is just a state of mind. Gay Davidson-Zilski, also known as Norma Gay Pruitt, is convinced her life is shaped by fortunate accidents. She claims she bumps into serendipity at least three times a week. She describes an incident in her poem, On Accident.
Though April showers may come your way, they bring the flowers that bloom in May. On accident, as children say, you decide to take a different road from work, turn your wheel a different way, and find the mailbox of a long-lost friend you dreamed about the night before. Coincidence, the world will scream. Superstition. You are not so sure. Or say, as happened to me the other day, you are inspired to write a poem by a single line that's rattling in your head. Mine was, I have known the hands already, known them all. So I began and wrote and wrote and stalled. I flipped a new tape into the player to shake the cobwebs and start my pen, and a voice began a poem called Hands. You must have known it. It causes a thrill like deja vu. Hearts beat faster and thought is confounded. It feels like magic, this fortunate fate. It's looking for something you think you want, but finding that something else you really need. It's a lesson from the universe, a tapping down of ego by the trickster, the unseen hand of an idiot savant, the dippiness of the three princes of the Serendip, a Persian tale from which we took the name. This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky with Mind's Eye Radio. So keep on looking for those bluebirds and listening for their song whenever April showers come along.
The list of serendipitous scientific discoveries is endless. Experimenter Christian Newhouse wonders, if we've managed to split the atom and land on the moon, is it possible to harness the powers of randomness and fate? Can we break the serendipity barrier?
Hello, this is Christian Newhouse. I'm in the Mind's Eye studio, where I will be locked in for the next half hour in an attempt to serendipitously create a radio sketch. I think of it as a metatextual study and not merely the cheap way out of actually writing a sketch that my critics are suggesting. To facilitate the serendipitous process, I have assembled before me a series of random objects. I can with confidence say that they are random, because I made a conscious effort to think of something other than locating and/or purchasing each object when I located and/or purchased it. The objects are a Darth Vader Pez dispenser, a cheesehead hat, a used copy of Valley of the Dolls, missing page 39, a cranberry scone, and a small ivory carving of a monkey. Additionally, I have a computer configured to periodically select and display a random web page. I am confident that this assortment will generate the spontaneity necessary for the serendipity experience. I will return at 2 points throughout the program to update you on my progress.
In the meantime, Max Gabler, a Unitarian minister, and then astrologer Ellen Baucus present conflicting views on whether serendipity exists.
Well, as a matter of fact, I really doubt that serendipity has anything at all to do with genuine religion. Actually, in mature religions, in all of the major world religions today, the notion that what we do can change history is limited to what we ourselves do. The notion that there's some strings that we can pull or buttons that we can push that will get other forces out beyond to do things, this doesn't really have any place in any present-day religion that I'm aware of. But certainly any theologian would say that prayer doesn't change the world, it changes us. It doesn't influence what happens, it influences the way we take what happens. And the paradigm for this is Jesus himself, who says, "Father, not my will, but thine be done." So that I would say that from my point of view, there's no significant connection between what's called serendipity and genuine religious belief.
In the business of noticing serendipity, the noticing itself leads to questions that begin to unpack the either-or view of the world. And from an astrological point of view, that we could find something by hunting around looking at what was going on in the solar system that seemed to make this connection, which I certainly don't have an explanation for. Serendipity is something like, it's got that feel to it that once you begin paying attention to it, it shows up all over the place. I would accept that it's eternally mysterious, but that doesn't mean you don't go hunting there, because I think it opens and opens, just like recognizing serendipity produces this really neat recognition of how much of it is going on. And it may even have, it may even begin to unravel our notions about good and bad. And it strikes me as an endlessly interesting conversation to have. If you don't let go of the why did this happen, and you get honest about what's happening, free will and fate disappears. I mean, it just dissolves out of that search. Because I want to know why that book fell off the shelf into my hands. Eastern philosophies and Eastern cultures just simply don't have this problem. They think it's a non-question. Notice, just noticing serendipity begins to open up the cultural story.
Thanks to Fran Rahl and Guy Thorvaldsen for interviewing Max and Ellen. While the word serendipity has been around for 250 years, you'll find serendipitous events in many ancient tales, and even a few modern ones, as writer Jackie Wilson explores in her story, The First Christmas Tree.
On the first Christmas night, the stars came down from the sky to join the earth's celebration. They twisted some clouds together to make a long slide and slid merrily down one by one. As they hopped to the ground, they landed waist-deep in snow and started to burn out, since fire and snow cannot exist side by side. In dismay, they tried to climb back up their slide, but it was so slippery they only tumbled down into the snow on their bottoms. They were being extinguished, and there was no place to turn for shelter, for only the night before there had been a blizzard. Just then a fir tree, hearing their cries of distress, bent down and offered them its branches. They clung to the undersides while the tree shook off its snow. Then all the little stars crept up to the top, and standing on each other's shoulders, peeped out from the friendly needles. When the other fir trees saw this, they cried out in alarm and rushed to the spot, thinking their friend was on fire. But when they saw what had happened, they were overwhelmed with the sight and offered their own branches. The stars jumped from one tree to the next, spreading out over the woods until the whole forest was a solid front of dark green and burning gold, creating such a beautiful vision that the angels themselves were drawn to the spot. And to preserve the memory of this event, they gave the Christmas tree to humankind.
That was writer Jackie Wilson. It's time to check in with Christian Newhouse and see how his experiment is going.
Succumb to the dark side of the Pez, monkey.
I will never turn. You'll be forced to kill me.
Hello, Mind's Eye, in association with the Writer's Place listeners. I have altered the components of the serendipity-generating experience slightly. I have eaten the scone. I have also decided that I will be best served by having my web browser constantly pointed at the Spandex and Lycra homepage. I will reintroduce the element of spontaneity by making a series of random phone calls, beginning now. Hello, who's this? Me? Well, my name's Christian Newhouse, and... Why, yes, you may have heard me on higher ground, miss. My voice? Why, you flatter me. Really? Well, excuse me a moment. I will return later on, listeners, with my final update. Sorry to interrupt you, miss. Please, go on.
It sounds like that experiment is going well. By definition, serendipity happens naturally, yet there are those people who try to force the issue. The Mind's Eye Players present one such person in their brief drama titled Miss Serendipity, written by Sue Renard.
Are you sure you don't know me? I'm positive we've met somewhere.
No, Michelle, no. We've gone all through this. Well, it was nice to meet you, but I see someone over there that I need to talk to. See you again later.
Right, Patty. I'm sure we'll run into each other again. I think I'll get me some snacks over at that table. Oh, excuse me, I wasn't watching where I was going. Say, what a coincidence! Aren't you Nick Vanderhovel?
No, I don't think we've ever met before. My name is Michael.
What a coincidence! My name's Michelle! Get it, Michael, Michelle? Say, didn't we go to high school together? I'm West High, class of 82.
No, I didn't move to Madison until 89.
Get out of here! I moved to a new apartment in 89! I still think I know you from somewhere. Didn't you once live on East Johnson out by Tenney Park?
No, I lived on Odana since I got here.
You're kidding! I once golfed at the golf course there. Do you golf?
No, I've never golfed. I prefer tennis.
What are the odds? I love watching Wimbledon. You ever been there to England?
No, the only time I've ever traveled abroad was to Mexico.
Oh, stop! You're killing me! I love Mexican food! Gee, it's strange us having so much in common. Stuff like this happens to me all the time. Guess you can see why I like to call myself Miss Serendipity.
Yeah, Michelle. Say, I think that's my ride leaving over there. See you later. Nice meeting you.
Okay, Michael. Bye.
Excuse me. Pardon me. Ooh, sorry. Did I make you spill your drink?
Just a little bit. Did I step on your toes?
No, I'm okay, thanks. I just wasn't watching where I was going. I was trying to get away from that creep over there.
Oh, you mean Miss Serendipity?
I see you talked to her too, huh?
Did I? She spent half an hour trying to convince me that we had everything in common. I'm a scuba diver, and she likes watching Jacques Cousteau specials.
Get out of here! You scuba dive? What a coincidence! So do I. I mean, I just love it. What are your favorite dive spots?
Well, I've had some really spectacular dives in the Caribbean and the Mediterranean, but Samoa is my absolute favorite.
Really? Samoa?
The hallmark of serendipity is that it happens to those who aren't looking for it. Writer Martin Saunders reinforces this point with his autobiographical piece called Going to the Dogs.
When I was young, I mean 12 or 13, I used to hang around at the dog track practically all the time. When I wasn't there, I'd be studying form. The lines of form were like poetry to me, and the study was a mystical divination into the future. The words and symbols described the nuances of a particular dog's ability to respond to the elements. I loved the track, the smells and the sense of expectation, the floodlit greens and the way that the crowds would mill around, seemingly aimlessly, until they became uncommonly focused for the 30 seconds of the race itself. At 16, I won enough money to buy my own racing greyhound. I lied about my age and registered him at the track at West Ham. Now, I was a part of the inner circle. Yeah, the track was a place for men. We could shout and scream and cheer with warrior voices. There was passion and desperation, and grown men didn't need to hide their feelings there. They glowed with joy and cowered in trepidation. Fortunes were turned on a bad bump at the first bend. The trick was figuring out which dogs were going to escape the balking, run clear, stay the distance, enjoy the track conditions, and so on. Most of all, there was the lure of winning, of beating the odds, of willing the dog to win, a supernatural connection, a refinement of one's intuitive faculties. You could often find me at the track with my head buried in the race program trying to find a winner. I was in a world of my own. At those times, I was unreachable, irritable, locked in battle with those elusive gambling muses. It was on a random Friday night during a long string of losses that I had a big argument with my now ex-wife. I took off in a rage and headed for the only place I could think of, where a man could be a man. As I drove toward the track that evening, the skies opened up. There was a terrific downpour and a marvelous rainbow. I remember the initial feelings of guilt that I had harbored for leaving so suddenly, and I remember them leaving my body. There was a calm, a rightness, a sense of independence. Mechanically, I went through all the usual steps of parking, entering the track, buying the program, sitting down, but I never looked at the program. I went to the betting window, and the numbers rolled from my lips for no particular reason. 1, 3, 8. I returned to my seat. I wasn't really even watching the race until the dogs hit the final bend. I looked at the dogs, recognized the colors of their jackets, red, white, stripes. I looked down at the ticket still in my hand. 1, 3, 8. The dogs passed the winning post in that order. I forgot to cheer. It turned out that I'd won almost $600, an amount many times in excess of anything I'd ever won before. Of course, I've probably spent at least that much since then, betting on 1, 3, 8. This is Martin Saunders for Mind's Eye Radio. Writer Karen Schultz doesn't believe divine intervention exists when it comes to the ability to accumulate wealth. In her piece, Chances Are, Karen recalls America's origins and the Midas touch of contemporary businessmen. We find the American dream takes on a new meaning.
Chances are. Commissioned to steal wealth from what we now call Asia, Columbus found instead America. What he first thought Indian was the Caribbean, what was Chinese was truly Cuban. The lucky victors in the end were the Spanish monarchs, whose serendipity had a financed jump start. Mexico's Aztec to the Spanish Cortez fell, thinking he was actually their god Quetzalcoatl. The French and English, looking again for a path to Asia, through the north found Hudson, the Great Lakes in Canada.
Chances of winning the lottery in the United States versus being killed in a hurricane are 1/15th as great.
The American tailor, Levi Strauss, made tents of canvas. In San Francisco, the miners begged him for pants. Pockets, too, they wanted, so he riveted them on as a joke. Later, he found French denim and died one of the wealthy folk. Another millionaire, Peter Gimble, found the sunken Andrea Doria, adding to his collection a million or four. Ray Kroc liked the combo of golden arches, milkshakes, and fries, and was in the top 10 richest when he died. The supposed Midas touch of these and many old boys was helped by the IRS, political parties, and other decoys.
Chances of getting a natural blackjack in a casino are 20-1, only if you go.
The stories and hopes which create the, quote, American dream tale started with a quality, handcrafted boat with hot wind in its sails. No getting around it. To get wealth, you need power, money to buy it, and gullible friends to devour. It's fun to believe wealth can fall in your lap, but Hard Luck Charlie would say it's easier to fall back. Workers are usually the vessel for someone else's bundle. While we think we've got a chance, the money gets funneled. Columbus died broke, trying to hang on. My chances are, at death, the money's gone.
Over 50 million North Americans believe in astrology.
For Mind's Eye Radio, I am Karen Schultz.
And this is Gonzalo Sanchez.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm in love with you.
Are we then just victims of fate and chance? Or is serendipity in the eyes of the beholder? Writer Guy Thorvaldsen was inspired by his young toddler's view on life.
Come on now, Isabel.
We've
got to get to the store.
In the sidewalk. Full of water.
Isabel, you're getting yours and your papa's pants all wet.
Between my toes. Maybe I can take my shoes
off. Isabel, what are you doing?
I can see
Don't
lots
sit down.
Of curly things.
You're all
what
wet.
What is this long, slippery
Isabel,
thing?
Isabel, please put down that worm. Honey, not in
that's
your mouth.
Good.
Oh, that's gross.
Gross must mean really
Isabel,
good.
Now, we're going to the store.
Okay, Papa. I'll get out of the puddle.
Isabel, that's the wrong direction.
That soft green stuff over there.
The store's
that
this way.
Interesting.
That's the park.
But if I lay on the green stuff, I can see blue sky.
Oh, all right, Isabel, you win. I guess the store will have to wait. Hey, can you see that beautiful cardinal up there in the tree? It's singing.
Hey, Poppy. You want some of this warm, brown, gooey stuff I found
Isabel,
next to me?
Isabel, what's that you've got?
It sticks to my
fingers.
Oh,
yuck.
Real
that's dog too.
Good. You want some?
Isabel, put it down.
Dog do.
Oh, Isabel, sweetie, you're talking.
Dog do.
Your first words, dog do.
Dog.
Oh, wait till we tell your mom. She'll be so proud.
To this toddler, all life is happy coincidence. But writer Pat Dejek sees many shades of possibility in life's events.
Hindsight being 20/20, I probably should have stayed in school and spent a third year on my master's. It would have been a good career move. And yet, a wise man once said to me, "What if everything you ever did was right?" Which makes me think that to get to the person I am now, maybe it was serendipitous that I left Kalamazoo when I did and returned to Madison. If I hadn't come back, my life would have been very different. I wouldn't have met my two closest friends or gotten the dogs I've loved and cared for these last 6 years. I wouldn't have taken that crummy job just for the insurance after my mother had an aneurysm and I was in a panic to find a, quote, secure position. I wouldn't have fallen in and out of love with the men that I have. I wouldn't have found out how strong I am alone. If, by chance, I hadn't come back to Madison, I wouldn't have discovered the way the broken ice sounds like wooden wind chimes around Governor's Island in the early winter. I'd never have known the excitement of watching the gray landscape along Interstate 90 turn a warm brown in March. If I hadn't come back, I still would have fallen in love, and my mother still would have gotten sick, but it wouldn't have been the same, and I wouldn't have become the person I am. So maybe I should thank my lucky stars I left school when I did. And maybe it only seems like serendipity to meet the people you become closest to in the world, or to make some mistakes that you manage to live through. Maybe it's really just how it has to be, being who you are and the way you interact with the world. Perhaps serendipity actually has less to do with the unexpected and more to do with being pleased with what you find. This is Pat Dijak with Mind's Eye Radio and The Writer's Place.
And now it's time for one last check with Christian Newhouse to see if he's happy with what he's found.
Hello, listeners. I regret to say that the serendipitous process has failed to initiate, and that I have not produced a radio sketch. I have, however, rewritten the missing page 39 of my copy of Valley of the Dolls, and solved the mystery of Edwin Drood. Charles Dickens did it. I can only hope that in the future, enough progress will be made in the field of serendipity-generating techniques so that I may undertake this experience again with more efficiency. Excuse me, listeners. I'll be right there. Well, friends, I would like to stay for another hour or two, but I'm afraid I've made plans. You might remember that phone call I made earlier. Quite a coincidence how that worked out. Almost a, what do you call it? Anyway, this is Christian Newhouse saying farewell. Hello.
Well, it seems like Christian's experiment wasn't such a failure after all. He went looking for a serendipitous radio sketch and ended up with a date. Was it luck or serendipity? You've been listening to Serendipity, or Finding What You're Not Looking For, written by members of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and was co-produced by Sue Renard. The show was written by Gay Davidson-Zilski, Pat Dijak, Christian Newhouse, Fran Rahl, Sue Renard, Martin Saunders, Karen Schultz, Geither Waldson, Kelly Warren, and Jackie Wilson. Original music composed by Barbara Chusett. Thanks also to the following Mind's Eye Radio players: Martha Stahl, Charles Colton, Pat Dijak, Sue Renard, and Geither Waldson. If you'd like a cassette copy of this show or would like to join the Mind's Eye Radio Collective, call 256-6525. I'm Cole Hornaday, Crown Prince of Outrageous Fortune.